Thank you. Thank you. Thank you and welcome. Welcome to Perimeter Institute's public lecture series presented by Sun Life Financial. Here, live at the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach at Perimeter, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening. And a special welcome to our online audience as we are webcasting around the globe. Welcome. I'd also like to recognize two people from Sun Life, Ian Bancroft and Jean-Marc Pointier. Welcome. Thank you for Sun Life's continued support of this lecture series. Thank you very much. The presentation will last approximately 1 hour, after which there'll be time for question and answer. If you want to participate in the online discussion, please use hashtag PILive. Now, specifically for our online audience, we have a chat room set up. We have some researchers and some of our outreach team in Boston ready to pipe in and answer your questions and engage in the conversation. So again, hashtag PILive to take part in that conversation. Now, many of you know that when Perimeter was founded, it was founded with focus on research and outreach activities. You may not know that another equally important focus is training. With a clear mission to ensure that Perimeter Institute was helping train the next generation of researchers, the Perimeter Scholars International, more commonly known as PSI, program was developed in partnership with the University of Waterloo. PSI is a unique and innovative training program that is intended to bring highly qualified and highly motivated graduate students to the cutting edge of theoretical physics in an intense and interactive learning environment. Students take all of their courses here at Perimeter, and then upon graduation are granted their Master's of Science degree from the University of Waterloo. Interestingly, each one of our panels is either a graduate from the PSI program or a current student of the PSI program. Perimeter Institute also has developed a very strong PhD training program and offers unparalleled opportunities for students to work with world-class researchers while also laying the foundations for a career in physics. The students enrolled in the Perimeter's PhD program are supervised by faculty members and then receive their degree from partnering universities where their supervisor has an affiliation. Our online partner tonight is Maclean's Magazine. We're very grateful for the opportunity to partner with Canada's weekly current affairs publication. And we are incredibly and extremely grateful and fortunate to have with us tonight, Kate Lunau. Kate is a Canadian award-winning science journalist. She is often on radio and TV broadcasts. Before her work at Maclean's, Kate was a reporter at the Montreal Gazette and CBC Radio in Montreal. Tonight, Kate will be moderating a panel to give you a window into the lives of young physicists. Please join me in both turning the evening over to and giving a hearty warm welcome to Kate Lunau. Welcome.
It's been really nice to be back in Waterloo today and spending the day at Perimeter. I haven't been here in several years, and actually my mom went to the University of Waterloo. She started in 1969 here in computer science, and it's really interesting talking to her about what her experience was like, you know, some four decades ago. She tells me about writing programs and having these stacks of punch cards that she had to, you know, to somehow use to program computers. I mean, to me, that seems like hundreds of years ago, but that's how much technology has changed. And I think, you know, we can also say that the field of physics has undergone just some huge changes over the last few decades. And I think that's what makes tonight's panel very exciting. Up here on stage with me are four young physicists, and they're all at the start of what are sure to be amazing careers. And, you know, it's these four and their peers who will be shaping the future of this field. So I'm very grateful to be here tonight with them and with you all at Perimeter. So I will now introduce our panelists for the evening. Here to my left, on the far left, is Jacob Barnett. At 15, he is Perimeter's youngest ever scientist. He began auditing university physics courses at age 8, believe it or not, and was fully enrolled at Indiana University by age 12. So he joined Perimeter's SCI program in 2013, and he has wide-ranging scientific interests that range from quantum gravity to string theory to cosmology and particle physics. Here we have Andres Schlieff, who comes from Bogota. And by the way, not only do we have former and current SCI students here, but we actually just realized in the green room from four different countries, so we're very well represented. So Andres comes from Bogota in Colombia. He is a current student in the SCI program, and his interests lie at the intersection of condensed matter, field theory, and quantum information. And he's interested in the exploratory power of physics, so I'm looking forward to talking to him about that. Here to my right is Nima Darood, who is a PhD student and was, I believe, in the first class of SCI several years ago. He's investigating gauge theory, which is a class of theories that describe particle interactions. And he's completing his PhD this year, and I believe he's off to Cambridge in the fall. And then on my far right is Lauren Hayward, who comes from Winnipeg. She received her master's degree in physics in 2012 through the SCI program, and she's now studying computational condensed matter theory. She completed her undergraduate degree in physics and computer science at the University of Manitoba. So we have a great panel here tonight, and as I said, it's a real pleasure. And so without further ado, let's get started. So one of my first questions, speaking with these young physicists, is, I guess, how you came to be interested in the field. And Andres, I think you have a really interesting story about this. Can you tell me, was there one moment or one pivotal event that really turned you on to physics?
I essentially reduced everything to the first time that I remember seeing lightning strike on a tree. I was very, very, very near the tree where it struck, basically, and I saw how it destroyed it shattered the tree. So in that time, I was like very curious, and I wanted to know how to explain what happened, right? I wanted to know what to understand what was like this so powerful thing that happened in front of me. So from there, I was like always like trying to, going to science magazines or going into the internet when I could. And essentially, I was trying to explore more about nature. A lot of it was like towards meteorology and weather, because it somehow like fascinated me how things were working. And at the end of the day, I had to make a choice, essentially, when I finished school, whether I was going to be a physicist or an engineer or a physician or any other thing. So I was very like towards science, towards physics or engineering. And when I thought about it, I thought I meant no disrespect with what I'm going to say, but essentially is that for me, engineering was incomplete to what I was intending to do, right? I wanted to understand fundamental things, fundamental questions, more than just how to apply those fundamental concepts into modern day life, right? Which is basically what engineering does. So I decided to go into physics at Los Angeles University, back home. And then there's another question I would like to address is like, why did I decide to work in theoretical physics rather than in experimental physics? And it's I know a lot of people know this story already, and maybe they are tired of hearing it, but I'll say it again. And it's I have like some sort of epiphany when I was on a lab back at home. We were doing some electron diffraction experiment, whatever that means. And essentially, so the machine was supposed to give me green circles, and whenever I touched the machine, it gave me green lines like spirals instead of circles. So I said like, okay, maybe the machine is broken. Then I take the next machine, I basically turn it on, and it was doing exactly the same thing. So every machine in the lab was doing what it wasn't supposed to do, until one of my colleagues told me like, please go for a walk, step outside from the lab. And as soon as I step outside of the lab, everything worked perfectly in the lab. And then I was like, okay, maybe I'm not meant for experimental physics. So that's why I decided to go towards theoretical physics, essentially.
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, and you know, Nima, I'd be interested to hear what you think. He speaks about how physics can teach us about nature. What can physics tell us about nature?
Well, At this point, it's like the theory in theoretical physics, we have gone so far that anything that is of relevance to our everyday life is already explained in one way or another by a well-known theory of physics. But the thing is that it opens questions that, as a physicist, it bothers us that something should fit, or two theories, let's say, should fit together in one theory. We call it unification. And when it doesn't, it really bothers us. So that's what we do as theoretical physicists. We concentrate on problems that we think are, give us a bigger picture, a better understanding of how nature works. So that's what we concentrate on instead of concentrating on describing this phenomena or that phenomena. There's a contrast between how I got into physics and how Andreas got. So I think for the lucky ones, there is really a pivotal moment where you decide that, oh, physics is for me. For me, it was rather the way circumstances were. Is that in high school I was good at physics and mathematics, and then when it was not that I was good at it. I was enjoying it. I was having fun when I was working on physics and mathematics problems. And then when I had to choose a major in university, I chose physics just because I enjoyed it. And then, as the years go by, it's like it's confirmed that this is what I enjoy doing, to the point where, whereas when you have a daily job, you go through your day, and at the end of the day, you think, oh, I've been productive. It's a reasonable hour to go home, and you go home and you get on with your life. Whereas when you're doing physics and you're working on a problem, it's not like, oh, this day has gone by or it's been a productive day. It's like the problem is not solved yet. I should keep working. It's a major problem.
The plight of a physicist. Jacob, I want to ask you, I know that before you came to Perimeter, you visited several, very prestigious universities to try to decide where to go. So why did you choose the Sci program at Perimeter?
There's a lot of really cool stuff that's going on here. Perimeter is at the forefront of a lot of different areas of research, and it's a very collaborative place you can go to. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I can just go to a condensed matter physicist and ask them a question, and they'll just give me some insight into it. So it was really nice for that. And I really like this Sci program because I'm being exposed to lots of different fronts of physics instead of just one.
Absolutely. And one thing I find so remarkable about the program is it's such a small group from all over, and you really do spend all day together. I mean, Lauren, tell me about that. When you moved here from Winnipeg, what was it like being thrown into this small group of students and suddenly breakfast, lunch, and dinner together, all these classes?
Yeah, well, definitely before I came, I was really nervous about it because I knew Perimeter had such a great reputation. There are really amazing physicists here. And I was really nervous about that. And the workload of the PSI program can be a little bit overwhelming when you start. But I think one of the best parts really is getting to interact with all these other students. That's one of the best parts of the program, I think. I've never made friends as fast as I did during the program, so it was a really rewarding experience. Mm-hmm.
And I think you were mentioning to me that when you moved here, you have a very eclectic group of friends back home. Not all of them are physicists. How did your friends and family respond when you said, I'm going to move to Waterloo and go to Perimeter and become a computational physicist?
Yeah. I think my friends knew for a while that I was interested in trying to do grad studies somewhere else. As you said, a lot of my friends and even my family aren't physicists, so I'm not sure they really understand what all comes with being a physicist. But they were definitely the ones who had heard about Perimeter were really excited for me.
Now, I'm very curious about what an average day is like for a physicist. And I mean, maybe we'll start with you, Andres. You're currently in the PSI program. What do you do? What did you do today? How was your day today?
Well, I mean, a general day in PI is essentially a lot of work, but at the same time, a lot of fun. I mean, I think most of us that are here in the program are very like motivated with physics so that we enjoy what we do. So in that part, it's a lot of fun too. But so let's say, what did I do today? I came here at 9 in the morning, had breakfast. Then we went to lectures, condensed matter explorations lecture and string theory explorations lecture. And after that, basically, we had lunch, and there's a little bit of time to spare with friends, with my girlfriend. At the end of the day, is essentially a little bit of work combined with fun, right? I would say that that's like the average day in the week. Right? On the weekends, it's different. I take my time to sleep quite a bit on the weekends, but I mean, there's room for anything. It's not that we're just working and working and working and working and nothing else. There's a lot of things. Mm-hmm.
And so, Jacob, I assume since you're in the program with Andres, you're going through all the same kind of stuff.
Yeah. So we have a roughly similar schedule. So I just find it really rewarding. We work through all of these very challenging problems, and it's very nice when you finally get to finish one. And it's like, it's not really like very many other feelings in the world. It's very exciting to have solved all these problems, and I really like being here because if I ever get stuck on any of those things, I mean, I can ask this guy, so.
Absolutely. And so in your own work, I mean, Jacob, tell me, what excites you about physics? I mean, what are the problems that you're interested in researching and addressing?
So nowadays, I'm interested in different models of quantum gravity. So quantum gravity, effectively, its goal is to try to combine our two most successful theories of physics. We have quantum mechanics on one side, which is extremely successful at describing things at very small scales and things that don't interact with each other very much. And we have general relativity, which is very successful at describing things which involve gravity. And it turns out the two are completely inconsistent with each other, and they don't really like talking to each other. And so I'm very interested in trying to see, say, are there ways that we can combine the two of them and exploring different options.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Is that something any of the rest of you are looking at in your own research? Is it a fairly, Nima, is it something, what are the problems that you look at?
The thing is, I work on string theory, which is mm-hmm. it started as a solution to this problem, mm-hmm. and to some extent it addressed some of the issues that arise in putting the two together. But there's so many things that have come out of string theory. Sort of, you know, it gives you a hint of how much we don't know about what are the possibilities and what are the theories that you know, could maybe not necessarily our universe, but could be a consistent universe that, you know, if you believe in parallel worlds, it might be out there. I don't, but so yeah, it's one of the most amazing things that people have realized doing string theory and quantum field theories in general is that it used to be that we believed that what ingredients you put in a theory, you put in some ingredients, you describe how they interact, and that gives you a unique theory that is going to be different from a theory with different ingredients or different interactions. That turns out not to be the case. It turns out to be there are these huge correspondences between very large classes of theories that at the surface look completely different. One of the ways, for example, that some people believe the problem of quantum gravity has been addressed to some extent is there's a correspondence in physics that, of course, the most concrete example is in string theory, which says you can have a quantum theory of gravity and it's completely equivalent to a theory that does not include gravity, hence removing the problem altogether. So yeah, my research connects to that, but it's not something that I directly work on.
And how do you plan to address that after you leave Perimeter? Will these be the types of questions you'll continue to look at?
Well, the questions that I look at are, as I said, it's the reason I keep enjoying physics is because I work on problems that I believe are fun. Mm-hmm. So if at a point the problem stops being fun, being, you know, we have to go out of our ways to solve some problems, mm-hmm. if they are very important. But if we are not close, it's, you know, as Andreas was saying, one of the things that we have to do is to take a walk. Mm-hmm. And you take a walk, you do something else, and you stumble upon some other problem that you think is interesting and you think it would be fun to solve. So that's usually what happens. If it stops being fun, I'll take a walk. And maybe I'll get around to it at some point. But it's not giving up. It's just clearing ahead, starting new, and trying again. And we have to do that over and over again until it's solved.
Well, and on that subject, and Andres, I'll address this to you, but you might all have thoughts on this. What is the value of theory? Why is theory so important? And you know, tell me about the value of theory in physics.
Well, I mean, we're living nowadays in a very like technological era, right? And that's in part a lot because of theoretical physics, because of people, very, very great minds, few years or many years ago as well, they essentially figured out how things work and how to exploit the way things work in order to construct things that would make our lives better. So I think theory, I mean, at the first glance, I would say like we theoretical physicists might seem a little bit like far from reality in the sense that we're working on problems that have no direct impact in everyday life, right? But I think that eventually, what we're doing here is just like building a pile of sand, and each one is just putting a small amount of sand into that pile, and eventually the pile will be big enough and strong enough so that it will help to be, I don't know, like the base of something very good for humanity. I don't know what it is. It might take some time, but I mean, I have faith in that, and it's been proven during this past years that theoretical physics pays off, basically. That's essentially my thought about it.
Well, and I would assume in a discovery like the Higgs boson particle, something like that, where you can really see, you know, a theory, I guess, coming to fruition, would that be the way of saying it? But yeah, it's pretty amazing. Lauren, I know that in your work you do computational physics, and I think you described this to me as sort of a bridge between theoretical and experimental physics in a way. Another theme we've been talking about tonight is just the collaborative nature of Perimeter. And so tell me about, you had a recent paper, I believe it was in the Journal of Nature?
Science,
of course. Tell me about that paper and how that came about.
Yeah, so I think it was really an interesting thing about being at Perimeter Institute, and probably really unique to the Perimeter Institute as well, is that this research really, I guess, started over just a conversation in the bistro at PI, which is something I think they really try to encourage here, is that if you see a physicist, even if they might not be working on something directly related to what you do, they still really encourage you to discuss your work together. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening is that an experimentalist from University of Waterloo and Sabir Sachdev, a researcher from Harvard, ended up figuring out that they might be able to work together to describe a new theory for superconductivity. So then my supervisor and I got involved with this, and we did the computational work associated with this project.
So what is superconductivity? What is the end goal of research like this?
So the basic idea is that for some materials at very low temperatures, electricity can flow with no energy loss. But the problem is that often these materials need to be cooled to very, very low temperatures, which can be quite difficult and quite expensive. So what our research does, we were trying to understand a regime of these materials that's called the pseudo gap, and this is basically what lots of these materials enter when they stop being superconducting. And so what we're basically trying to do is come up with a theory of this regime. And as a very long-term goal, I guess the idea would be that we could contribute to a more complete theory of superconductivity so that one day we might be able to find ways to find new materials or manipulate materials to push the superconducting temperature higher so that we can have superconductors at higher temperatures.
Hmm. And I believe your other research project relates to quantum computing. Is that right? Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think it's actually something really interesting about computational physics is that sometimes very similar methods can be applied to really different projects. So as I said, I applied some of these methods to a problem in superconductivity, but then they can also apply to quite different problems. So for example, something that's more related to quantum information. So those types of projects, I guess more what I would work on is looking at a system that might be relevant to us one day if we did develop a quantum computer, and we would basically see how the information in this quantum computer would behave as we change temperature, because information kind of behaves a bit differently in quantum computers, so we're kind of studying what that looks like.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about quantum computers? What are we talking about when we're talking about quantum computers?
Okay, so I guess the fundamental difference is that in a classical computer, information is just stored as a series of bits, so a state that's either one or zero. But in quantum computers, it's fundamentally different. We can have states that are in a combination or a superposition of these ones and zero states, but they behave quite differently, and we can even have two particles that are two qubits. We call these bits of information qubits. They can be entangled so that we can't really describe each one individually. We really have to look at them as a complete pair. And really just the algorithms that you can use when you're working with these fundamental pieces of information are very different than with classical computers. And it turns out that lots of the algorithms end up being a lot more efficient on quantum computers. So I don't directly work on making a quantum computer. I more look at what we would have to do to store the information if we one day did have them.
That's fascinating. And now, Andres, I want to ask you a little bit about your interests in physics and your goals. You know, when you finish this Sci program, what do you see yourself doing next, and what kind of problems do you wish to tackle? Big question.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, my interests right now are very broad, I'll say, but they might reduce only to condensed matter field theories, a little bit of string theory.
And can you tell us, first of all, condensed matter, when we're talking about that, what are we talking about?
Well, I mean, there's the old school of thinking about condensed matter, which is essentially material science. But as it has been seen last years, condensed matter goes far beyond from that. And it has a connection even with other fields that at the first glance, you will think that they have no connection at all. Mm-hmm. There's people working on condensed matter systems where there is emergent space-time, and this has to do with quantum gravity, right? So it tries to explain, in a broad sense, the phases of matter. How do they behave? How do you have a phase transition? You just change from one phase of matter to another. Let's say the classical example is you have water. How does it change from being liquid to being solid by just turning the temperature? So it goes far beyond from that, and it goes into a more broad like class of we'll say like phases of matter, which are the topologically ordered phases of matter, which is been an active topic of research here at Perimeter during a few years now. And from there, there's a lot of universality in the physics that can be like connected to other fields of physics. So I'm not saying that condensed matter is just a unification theory or at all, right? But I think it gives very good insight into different fields of physics. That's mainly my interest, I would say. However, I feel here in PI like in a child in a candy shop. I don't know. there's so much things like people working in here. Like somebody's like, oh, quantum gravity, and I mean, there's too much things to do. Mm-hmm. I know there's little time, but it would be awesome if I can work in everything. But I know that's very utopic. I don't know. So my long-term goals will be, I think I'm staying here at PI to pursue my PhD, and I think I might go through the lines of combining condensed matter field theories, a little bit of string theory, and I think that as for the fundamental questions that I would like to answer, I don't know. That's a tough one. I probably will relate more like what Nima was saying before, that I work on things that are fun to me. I'm not so fundamental, like I don't address fundamental questions because I think I don't have the background yet. Probably in the future I will.
Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, I want to ask you, as I mentioned, Perimeter's youngest ever scientist, and obviously everyone on this panel is a young physicist. What are some of the challenges and advantages of being a young physicist in this field?
I think that a lot of the really great discoveries that come out of physics are often done by young people, mm-hmm. just because when young people first enter a field, they can come in with new insights that people didn't previously have before. They're not sort of brainwashed into thinking in old way of solving some problem. They have this new ideas, and they certainly can pursue them. And so it's a really great time to do physics if you're young, or if you're early on in your career.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any challenges specific to being a younger physicist at the start of your career?
Challenges. Oftentimes you're doing a combination of trying to implement these new ideas you're coming up with and still learning what all has occurred in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that can be a difficult thing to manage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Lauren, what about being a young woman physicist? I'm assuming, you know, we hear a lot about the sciences still being male dominated. Mm-hmm. And what's your impression as a young female physicist?
I think there definitely are challenges associated with being a woman in physics just because we're a minority. And so maybe we stand out more, and I always feel everybody's watching me, you know, I have to be careful what I do. But I think for me, a big advantage is that I feel that if I did do something, maybe it could make a big impact on other women, because I think it's really important that we do encourage more females to get involved in physics, and so I think maybe I have more of an opportunity to inspire that group of people.
Absolutely. Nima, going back to you, I mean, again, you're completing your PhD. You obviously have years ahead of work of you. In the field of physics, what do you think are the questions that are going to sort of define this field over the next 20 or 30 years?
One of the topics that I sort of brushed upon is these correspondences that we've found between different theories that maybe 50 years ago, if you asked someone, they would have thought that it's completely ridiculous. So it's very important that we realize we are at a point where experiment can no longer guide us into what are the ultimate solutions, what is fundamental and what is not, because theoretical physics has advanced so much that, you know, everything experimental, every experimental data that we have is pretty much explained by very many different theories, because, you know, when people write down new theories, the first thing that they do is to check whether it is consistent with of everything that we've observed so far. But one of the things that could be a very important guide is to understand the landscape of possibilities. To know what are the theories that we could possibly write down that are similar to our universe. And once we know, it's sort of knowing our surroundings. Then once we know what we are surrounded on, it might be easier. I'm not saying it is, but it might be easier for us to see a clear direction ahead. You know, this is for example, the problem of quantum gravity, as Jacob was mentioning. It might become clear that, oh, this is a very promising path to take to maybe guide us towards a theory of quantum gravity to write down to write down a theory that describes quantum mechanics and general relativity in a unified form. So yeah, that's what I think is the most important. It's one of the most important research fields that people pursue now and hopefully more in the future. Mm-hmm.
Jacob, did you have any thoughts on the discovery that was, I guess it was announced last week or the week before, was it on the gravitational waves that were detected, echoes of the Big Bang?
I think this is a really huge deal, primarily because we finally have had some actual testing of gravitational waves, which is something that we all sort of thought was going to be there, but we didn't originally see, and I think that's really promising. I don't necessarily know if it implies inflation, as people are rushing to claim. I think that the data needs to be sorted out a little bit more, mm-hmm. but it's really, really promising because it is the first experimental result we have had that is inherently quantum mechanical and gravitational in nature. So some people think that maybe this could provide some kind of a testing for quantum gravity physics, maybe testing some of the models that have been created over the last 50 years, like string theory or loop quantum gravity.
And I mean, just continuing on that topic, you know, we've talked a little bit about quantum gravity, but to you, what are some of the big remaining problems and questions in physics that might define, you know, the coming decades?
So there certainly are a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So if we're focusing on gravitational ones, I've already mentioned that before this bicep thing, we haven't had any experimental tests that are both quantum mechanical and gravitational in nature, and that's just because the scales at which you expect quantum gravity to show up are actually extremely, extremely small. Mm-hmm. So it's an important question maybe to test these kinds of ideas. Other problems in gravitational physics, there's stuff that's often portrayed. There's dark matter and dark energy. Basically, if you look out at nature and you try to look at the amount of mass you find in a galaxy, it ends up being substantially less than what you calculate through gravitational effects, and so this is called dark matter. And there's dark energy, which is also sort of pushing the universe apart. So maybe could a theory of quantum gravity describe these effects? Is it something that has to do with particle physics?
That's fascinating. What do you think, Andres? Do you have any, you know, thoughts on big questions we haven't talked about?
Well, I have a little bit more like the pessimistic view of these kind of things, because so through history, physics have been like experiment driven up to a point where essentially technology doesn't allow you to see more than you actually see nowadays. So, I mean, as example, most of, for example, condensed matter physics, most of the models we know now were built to try to explain results that we saw in experiments, right? Nowadays, theories have gone so far up high, then I think that experiments are now theory driven in the sense that we're designing our experiments to look for things that our theories predict, but we don't know if those things will exist or not. So maybe the experiment is set up in such a way that the data that I'm taking doesn't allow me to see the real phenomena, right? I think there's a problem with that. I mean, maybe I'm too naive, but I'm very skeptical with this sort of results. I'm no expert at all in quantum gravity or gravitational waves or anything, but I think that we still have to wait a little bit more to see if there's any other research group that actually confirms what the bicep did, right? Because, I mean, it's good that they have the first signal. Everyone is very hyped that because it basically agrees with the theory of inflation, but it doesn't mean that this is the ultimate theory that explains what happened in the so-called Big Bang, right? So I think we should wait a little bit until we have confirmation from other part. Maybe other research groups will have different data, or I don't know. So I think, I mean, my view about physics is more like physics is more descriptive than explanatory. And I think a lot of people would disagree with me in this, but what we do with physical models is describe what nature does. It by no means is an explanation of why things are happening. So in these cases, as we were talking before about these results of the bicep, it agrees, the data agrees with this model, right? This inflation model. It might agree with another model, right? So there's a choice then on basically which is the model that I would like to explain my theory, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of which is the model that describes accurate my physical phenomena, mm-hmm. right? I think those are two different things that one has to have in mind, whether I'm describing or I'm explaining, right?
Lauren, I know when we spoke earlier, you mentioned alongside research, and we've been talking a lot about research, you also have an interest in teaching. So tell me a little bit about your goals for your career once you finish your PhD.
So I guess I'm not completely positive what I'll do when I'm finished my PhD, but for sure, as you said, I think I would really like to keep involved with teaching and hopefully research as well. I really think that as physicists, we have a responsibility to inspire the next generation. And for me, I feel always a huge sense of accomplishment when I know that I've helped somebody to understand something in physics, or especially if I've helped them to get excited about it. And I really think that as well as coming up with important discoveries, we also need to make sure that we have inspired people to come up with discoveries in the next generation as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, you know, a good argument for hopefully doing an event like tonight. I mean, Nima, maybe we'll go to you. Why do you feel it's important to communicate your work to the public? Why participate in an event like this?
Well, one of the things, this is very rare in Iran, actually, to have public events and like, really, actually, there is no such thing as outreach as it exists here. So I was very impressed when I first came here to know that there is actually an outreach team. Like the very existence of it was a great surprise. And then the extent to which, you know, the work they do to make sure that the public knows what people at Perimeter are up to and why is it important. I think it's somewhat a responsibility that we have as physicists, because most often institutes like Perimeter have funding that comes also from the public. So it's a responsibility that we communicate what we do with people and why we do it in the first place. I said earlier that like the problems that I work on is fun, but it's not like I only do it because it's fun. It's because I believe through working on similar problems, I might be able to understand something more deep about nature. And that's very important to communicate, because otherwise, from an outsider's point of view, I'm basically, you know, not producing anything that is of any importance to potentially the next few generations. So. In that sense, it's very important that the public knows what we're doing, and agrees, of course, that what we're doing has some importance for humanity and for human knowledge, and hopefully it ends up adding to it rather than wasting people's money.
Jacob, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on the same question. Why did you decide to participate in this event? Why is it important to tell the public about your interest in your work?
So I really think that a lot of people are born with this curiosity of how nature is working. Mm-hmm. And say you can go outside and you can wonder a lot of these different phenomena. And Andres has a story about lightning in the tree, yeah, for example. And it's absolutely fascinating how all of these things work, and physics gives us the best insight into how nature is working. So I think it's important to communicate to people the successes that we've had in trying to describe different problems of nature, what's still left out there for us to explore, and hence why we still have jobs.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Andres?
Well, I may come back to an answer I gave before. I think that the shortcoming, what we're working on might have an impact many years after us, but I think it's worth doing it. I mean, history has proven that what theoretical physicists did before is why we now live with all these luxuries, if you want to call it. I mean, that we're living in this technological era where we have a lot of things that rely on just basic physical principles, and physical principles that people essentially exploded. And I think it's good to take this information out there into the people, into the public, and just tell them that essentially we're not living in our own world, as most of my friends think, at least. we're not just living in this like imaginary world of math and like very, very hard physics. It actually turns out it reduces to something real at the end of the day. So it's good, and at least if I was an outsider of this world, I would be interested in knowing how does the world works, right? I mean, there's curiosity of almost every human has that curiosity of knowing how the things work, how the world around us work, and why things happen the way they happen, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's somehow, for me, it would be like hearing a physicist talk and giving me like simple explanations will give me some sort of closure or relief. I'll be comfortable knowing how things work. Mm-hmm. And then I can go in my daily life, I suppose. But I mean, this is a tough question because nowadays theories are very, very like involved, and there's somehow I think there's some technological like difficulties to go beyond these theories and try to apply what we're doing right now. But I think in the future it's going to be possible.
I think just to ask you a follow-up question, when we spoke last week, you were talking about the physics community in Colombia and possibly returning there one day. Can you talk to me a little about that?
Well, yeah. So essentially, I come from a country where it's more important to be a politician or essentially work in TV than being a scientist or a doctor or anything. It's a little bit sad, I know, but... So the thing is that education there is good. However, there's not much resources given towards science, right? And there's just one, there's one or few of like investors that give money to several like little groups of people. So they don't give the opportunity to a lot of like very talented people. So my idea, essentially, or my philosophy in this is just going outside from my country, get educated in the best places. That I can, and then come back and try to make the difference. Come back probably to my university or any other place where I feel that I can do something, that I feel that I can provide this same opportunity that I'm having here. I wanted to provide it to other people and somehow show people there that science matters and that investing in science pays off at the end of the day. I mean, it might be impossible, I don't know, but it's worth trying it.
Right? I know it's been several years since you left Tehran, but how does that compare to the situation, physics in Iran?
It's actually very similar to Colombia in that the educational system, we do have very good lecturers, very good teachers. The educational system, for the most part, works, but then again, there's not a lot of funding for sciences. So, I mean, for me specifically, based on my interests, it was, you know, the universities here are just a far better choice because as the farther you get outside of the world of experiment, and you know when you lose touch with everyday life in sciences, then basically people are very, very skeptical of providing any funding because they're not going to get anything out of it for the most part, unless they actually care about human knowledge, which is rare. So, I mean, so it is at Perimeter at least is I mean the support that Perimeter has is of course very impressive and. The outreach events, I mean, the how people, I mean, you've basically almost filled this auditorium, which is amazing. Such an event in Iran would not have, you know, there would not be so much interest in Iran. And it also speaks about how Perimeter itself is supported so that people in Perimeter can do their research without actually worrying about their funding running out, or you know, all these issues that financial or otherwise that might be a problem in countries like Iran or in Colombia. Mm-hmm. So I did want to go back to your last question for a second because Jacob made a very good point about people having this natural interest. One of the things that I should have mentioned is. Not only we have the responsibility to explain what we do, but there are also enthusiasts out there who, if the material is available, they actually go and learn by themselves. And even some of them have very good ideas of what we do or what might be a possibility. I get that from engaging actually with the public in the public events here, like the Brainstem a few months ago, a little bit more than a few months ago. I mean, it's also a responsibility. Something that we owe to them, to people who are interested, to make the material available to people who are not maybe as equipped in the technical sense, but are actually interested in knowing how we describe physical phenomena or what we actually do. So yeah, that's something that I wanted to emphasize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jacob, I'll put this question to you, and I'm interested to hear what all of you think, but given your work in physics and the community that you're immersed in, are you optimistic about the future?
I am optimistic about the future. Very recently, we have started to discover a lot of very interesting ways in which we can apply quantum mechanics in order to create new devices and create new technologies. And
can you give some examples?
So I think she mentioned the quantum computer earlier, mm-hmm. and that would make a lot of different protocols a lot faster. It would allow for a lot of different simulations that couldn't have been done before. You can do a sort of type of quantum cryptography. Basically, you can use quantum mechanics to safely encode different types of messages. The current methods, which are currently used in cryptography, you just say, oh, I have this math problem of factoring. It's very hard for a computer to solve. But because of that, I can use that to my advantage. That's more of like a mathematical advantage. You can actually use physics and quantum mechanics to your side and use that to safely encode data, which I think is very cool. And there's a lot of these different applications which are currently being discovered right now, and I think that's very cool. It shows that the things that the physicists working on, the original people working on quantum mechanics, is actually useful, because now we're understanding, okay, how do I manipulate nature into doing what I want it to do? How do I get to do what I want to do given these quantum mechanical resources? And in order to understand how to manipulate nature, you must first understand how nature works. So I think that, again, doing these physics things and learning about this theory is going to end up paying off in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lauren, I'd be interested to hear what you think about that, since you also work on related topics.
Mm-hmm. Well, in general, I think definitely it's exciting to think about the future. I think something that's really exciting is that we never really know what's going to happen. Sometimes a discovery happens that we weren't expecting, and I really think we're always building on knowledge. We're always growing, we're always learning more, and I think it's just don't know where things are going to take us, and I think that's something really exciting about the future. In terms of my research, yeah, I think that there could be some really exciting advances in superconductivity. As I've mentioned earlier, I'm not exactly sure what time scale that would be on, but I think that's definitely very exciting. But overall, I'd say it's just exciting to be surprised, to not really know what's going to come.
And for us watching your work also, Nima, do you have anything to add on that topic? Are you optimistic about the future?
I care about it. I am optimistic, but in the sense that we understand more and more how we can describe our universe and what are the things that we should focus on. And that's very promising. But whether something would actually come out of it that would be useful, I mean, one of the things that I would like to emphasize is that we try to attack some problems, but it's the problem that we're focusing on is sometimes not as important as the tools that we develop to get there. A very good example is actually the internet, which I might have mentioned before, is people at CERN who were trying to do these experiments with colliding particles and testing the particle physics, the standard model of particle physics. They had to develop a way to communicate and make their data available across all of CERN. And so the internet was born. And I mean, of course, I cannot stress how important internet is to our everyday lives nowadays, and what role it has probably changed all of our lives in a very, it has touched upon everyone's life nowadays. Like it's hard to imagine our world without internet. So I mean, there are things that would come out, and I'm optimistic that would keep happening. That great things would come out, even if we don't end up in the short run We don't end up solving the problems that we think are important. Important achievements might come along.
Mm-hmm. Andres?
Well, I'm pretty optimistic, although I think it's also dangerous in the sense that nobody knows in which hands these theories can end up into, right? So what Jake was talking about, this cryptography and making protocols faster and all of this stuff might be used not for the good things, but just for very like harmful things. So I'm optimistic, but I think we have to be a little bit cautious on this type of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're ready to start taking questions from the audience. So please feel free to queue up at the microphone if you have questions for our panelists. But what we'll start with is a question from Twitter. And again, please tweet to PI Live if you have any questions and are watching our webcast. So Greg, please take it away.
Okay, this one actually comes from Damian Pope, Dr. Damian Pope from Boston, but I heard an elementary student ask him this question not a week ago, so here it is. Do you ever worry that physicists will solve everything and there won't be anything left for you to figure out?
Or for me to report on.
At the end of the 19th century, this was actually a huge concern. People had thought, okay, we have electrodynamics, we have classical mechanics, we have thermodynamics, this is it. We're able to describe everything we see. Nowadays, we see that was a completely absurd thing to think. We have all this crazy quantum mechanics and general relativity and particle physics. So it may be very difficult to actually run out of problems.
Anyone else have anything to add?
That was quite to the point.
So we'll take a question from a gentleman at the microphone.
Well, thank you very much for this evening. My exposure or my thoughts about physicists was muchly based on Sheldon on the Big Bang Theory, so it's changed dramatically. But I guess my question is in terms of collaboration, are you competitive with each other internationally, or have you found yourselves working together more closely, or is there a dynamic that I'm not aware of that's developed between you two? Is the world becoming closer and you're sharing ideas a lot more freely? Or is there little pockets of closed ideas and nobody's letting them in because of some competitive spirit?
Well, there's a little bit of both. I mean, some groups are... It is very competitive, but for the most part, it's healthy competition. So it drives... people to work harder, get their ideas out as soon as they can and like as concise as they can. But physicists are actually a good example among scientists as putting their ideas out, making it available as soon as possible. Is that it used to be that when we came up with something, like say a theory, or we managed to describe we solve a certain problem, it would have to go through this process of being peer-reviewed and then published in a journal. And people realize that causes a lot of problems, among which is that people won't be able to start working as a, you know, on follow-up projects right away. So we, Paul Ginsberg, I think, or actually, I don't remember the name, so let me not name someone, but someone came up with the idea of making a website that's just called The Archive, where as long as you're a physicist or affiliated with an institution to basically, it's sort of a filter to make sure that you're an academic. If you solve a problem or you have an idea, you can just write a paper and post it on there and everyone will see it the next day. I don't know if anyone has.
Well, I mean, I agree with what Nima says. I think there's everything within the physics community. There's healthy competitions, there's unhealthy competition too. I mean, I come from a place where I've seen both things. Even in the Psi program, the first like months, so the acceptance letter says like, okay, we just pick up you, we picked you up from a very large like group of people that were very like qualified for the place. So in my experience, like almost everyone came here with a high ego, I would say. I mean, it's not bad, but after each one met each other, we basically realized that this competition of trying to be the best and trying to show off is not what is driving physics to be what it is. So more or less after the second month or third month, basically everyone just gave up on trying to be like the best and just cooperate with each other, right? I've seen also this at PI, it's something that it was new to me. It's like anyone that it's at PI that you want to ask a question, they're willing to answer it, right? Or at least they will be polite and tell you like, okay, come later because I have no time, right? That's a very good thing because you can share your ideas without fearing that they're going to steal them and basically publish your ideas, right? I mean, the cases have been seen in other places, I guess, but I think good physics is done with this good, healthy competition.
Thank you.
Hello. I have a question for Lauren about quantum computing. Do you use conventional computers to simulate quantum computers?
Yes. And
if you do, is there one available on the internet that I can play around with?
So there's, we do use standard computers to model problems in quantum information for sure. So I'm sure there's some algorithms, I'm sure some of them are widely available. So something that I use is various methods in something called quantum Monte Carlo, so that's something you could look up. That's something that I would do on a day-to-day basis. But definitely we don't have a big enough quantum computer yet, so everything that we're studying, we're mostly making use of normal classical computers.
Thank you.
Relativity and quantum mechanics were radical departures from the way that we thought before that. My question is there any theory being put forward by some really legitimate theoretical physicist on the planet that is so out there that is a radical departure from what we currently believe?
Pretty much any theory of quantum gravity or beyond the standard model physics fits that definition.
Okay. That's it. Pretty much any of them?
No, the thing is, it goes back to the question earlier, which is one of the benefits of having this archive website that I mentioned, that you can freely you can freely post your papers and share your ideas, is that there are papers that would not have otherwise been published by a peer-reviewed journal that may or may not have any legitimate grounds, but there certainly have been papers that were so out there that if the authors had tried to publish them in a journal, they would have completely failed. String theory is an example, though. Archive, I don't think, was available at the time. But string theory, the very first paper on string theory that Leonard Susskind was trying to publish was rejected because it was so out there that no one believed it would be of any use. So yeah, there are definitely examples of proposals that, you know, are debatable whether they're actually legitimate or not. It's up to debate.
I was just wondering, as a student, what one thing in high school you did that you're most glad that you did do now in your later academic careers?
Whoa.
So who wants to start? Lauren, do you want to, we'll take it this way?
That's a great question. I have to just think about a good answer. I think in high school, this is just what comes to mind right away. I might be able to come up with a better answer later, but I would just say that I really tried to expose myself to a lot of different kinds of areas to really make sure that physics was what I wanted to do. Actually, at the time, I wasn't planning to go into physics, but I think I would just say take advantage of as many opportunities as you can, because for me, actually, this was not in high school, it was in university. I didn't realize I was going to be interested in computer science until I took a class in it. I was really not expecting to like it. So I would say have an open mind and try different things.
Mima, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's the possibilities for a career out there. There are so many possibilities that really, I mean, I completely agree with Lauren that you should try to know about as many areas as possible. But it's pretty much completely impossible for you to know. If you found a perfect match, follow it, is what I would say. But otherwise, it's really completely impossible to know about every career opportunity that you have out there. So yeah, I mean, I enjoyed physics and I latched onto it. But it's not always like that for everyone.
Andres?
Well, I'll give more like the esoteric kind of answer. It's like, just be aware of the signs that life gives you, right? In my case, I have this sign to become a theoretical physicist. I agree with what Lauren and Nima said.
Jacob, do you have any thoughts?
I never formally went to high school, so I... But I would still definitely agree with Lauren and Nima's advice. Just explore as many different options as you can. You'll know things about yourself in the future that you don't know about yourself right now.
Thank you.
Do we have another question from Twitter?
We do. So here it is, from a teenager. Do any of you watch The Big Bang Theory, or does it just irritate you that they are sometimes false based on all the physics knowledge that you have? That's from @BlairShaw17.
I hate that show. No, seriously, I hate that show. I don't know, it might be scientifically correct or whatever, but I think I hate it because I just got tired of being called Sheldon by my brother's friends. So, anyone else?
I have to say, having not watched the show, that I find it comes up at science communication seminars sometimes, because while not everyone has a grasp of theoretical physics or even will attend an event like this, so many people have seen the show and have at least a passing understanding because of it. But I don't know how accurate you could say it is, having, again, not watched it.
I mean, I think some of the things they say are definitely accurate, maybe not everything, and definitely maybe some of the things they do aren't exactly what we would do on a day-to-day basis, but but I think for me, I actually, maybe it sounds silly, but I do get excited when they make a joke, and I think, hey, I might not have understood that a few years ago, and now I actually know what they're talking about, so I don't think it's terrible.
Do we have any more questions from the audience? Please feel free. Or Greg from Twitter?
Sure, here's another Twitter question. Is there a sense of fear with discovery, especially as a developing scientist?
You know, if you make a discovery that you think is amazing, especially if you're a young physicist, chances are, and it's something to fear, that your elders, I say elders, the seniors in the field are going to completely disagree with you. And having the background that they have and this, you know, the knowledge that they have, there is always the fear that they will completely demolish whatever idea you've come up with. So there is always that fear once you come up with an idea is for your supervisor or whoever you discuss it with to say that it's completely wrong. But once they, if they don't though, it's amazing.
Do either of you ever feel afraid when you're on the verge of a big new discovery, or nervous even?
I haven't had a discovery yet, but when I, some idea pops up in my head, I have this fear because I think that's one of the disadvantages of being young in a theoretical physics community, because there's a lot of background that one is missing, and being young, somehow people won't take you seriously, or they would say like, okay, you're too young, just go think about it. It's like, your idea is okay, but go think about it. I mean, it might happen. So, of course, there's a fear, but I mean, you have to live with that, right? You have to try to exploit that and somehow use that into your to your favor. I'll say, is that how you say that? Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have another question?
To wall on the spot a little bit and just ask for your predictions about where you think the next great breakthrough will be in theoretical physics that will basically reshape the world, as has happened several times in the past.
Great question.
Well, one of the exciting things about physics is that we don't know where exactly it's going to lead us. We just do it so that we can try to understand how nature is working. Who knows what's going to come out of this stuff? Who knows if it's going to be completely worthless or if it's going to be something which everyone is going to use every day in the form of a cell phone?
Well, I would say, like, in terms of just theoretical physics, staying a little bit apart from reality, whatever, I'll say that quantum foundations has a lot of things to do in that direction. I think, for example, quantum information, condensed matter, they're trying to do things that theory already predicts, or basically, as Lauren and Jacob were pointing out, they're trying to build a quantum computer with a theory that we already know. However, I think that there should be a major breakthrough in the moment that we really know how to formulate quantum theory in the right way. This might not happen in 10 years, 20 years, or anything, but there's a fundamental problem here, and it's that essentially we're addressing to a quantum theory from a classical perspective, and it should be the other way around. It should be that you should have a well-established quantum theory, and from there you should recover the classical physics that we know. That's something that we're not been able to do very well. We're usually using this straightforward program or basically recipe of taking a classical theory and let's quantize it. Okay, so I have this theory, I have this recipe, I quantize it. And I build a lot of like quantized theories that might have problems. And that's one of the major criticisms, for example, for this quantum gravity, at least for loop quantum gravity. They're trying to use this recipe of quantizing general relativity as if it was a usual field theory. And I think I might be wrong, or I might be too naive, that this is fundamentally wrong and we have to fix this, right?
Any thoughts on the next big discovery?
I think the most, in terms of shaping our next 100 years, I think the most promising areas are really condensed matters, the areas that Lauren works on, like quantum computing, because they are the ones that are the closest. Quantum computing and actually superconductivity, which would be a revolution. If we discover high temperature superconductivity, it is really going to be a major change.
Why is that? Why is that going to be such a revolution?
Well, imagine if we have high temperature superconductivity. One of the things that, I mean, as Lauren described it, it's you can have electrical currents run through superconductors without any resistance whatsoever. It's like, it's not almost zero, it's exactly zero. And that, for one part, it helps a lot with, I mean, there's a lot of applications in technology, of course. Imagine the waste that you have in your computers, all the heat that your computers generate and you have to have the cooling systems is because of the electrical resistance. So there are applications there, and of course there are wider applications to making electricity and communications available to. It has such applications. I'm not the expert to speculate on the applications in mm-hmm. in technologies, but they're certainly very wide-ranging.
Would you agree, Lauren?
Yeah, definitely. I think Nima said a lot of things that I would have said, but I'll just add to something that Jacob touched on, I guess. Just that I think we don't always know where the next big thing is going to be, but one thing I think is really exciting is that even if we're not talking about quantum computers, computers are just becoming more and more powerful mm-hmm. these days. And so, but again, I think it's very true that we don't always know what the next big thing is going to be, but mm-hmm. certainly some of the things Nima mentioned are things I would have talked about as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, should we take one more question?
When you run when you simulate the quantum computers on a classic computer, how do you ensure that they would actually work on a quantum computer?
So I would say that I don't actually work on simulating a quantum computer. It's a fine difference, but I more work on models that we would use if we had a quantum computer. But there are certainly a lot of theory that people understand about how qubits, the bits of quantum information, work. But definitely there are certainly some things we couldn't know until we had it in a lab. I'm not sure if this really answers your question, but.
Yeah, kind of. Thank you.
Well, we have a little bit more time, so.
Thanks. So this question, Nima mentioned that you're saying it's one of the duty for the institution and also academia in general to make the information available to the general public. As you mentioned, there's enthusiasts all over the world trying to learn more. Now, making the information available is a one-way communication. Is there a way to kind of have this feedback from the public or the enthusiast? Because with the decentralization of the knowledge with the internet and everything that's available online now, there is definitely a lot of stuff building in, outside the academia. Is there any way, for example, through, a department in the PI institution that you can actually get this feedback?
There are channels, but you can imagine that they would have downsides as well as upsides.
Yes.
But there are certainly public events at Perimeter. When Perimeter is open to the public, we always have these Ask a Scientist booth. That is basically for discussions with the public. They can ask questions. They can also bounce out their ideas and have us give our thoughts on it. It has happened a few times here.
Perfect. Thank you.
We have two more gentlemen at the microphone, so we'll take two more questions.
When you get sucked into a black hole, what would happen?
Well, you would probably die first before being concerned about what would happen to you. One of the first things that would happen to you, you would kind of get stretched out by a lot, just because the gravity at your feet will be a lot stronger than the gravity at your head, so you're going to get kind of tall. You're eventually going to collapse at the singularity, and you're just going to be one point, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
And our last question for the evening.
What would you be doing if you weren't in physics?
In an alternate universe.
I don't know about... I mean, all of us have, of course, very many passions that we don't necessarily follow because of the requirements from our career, the physics. But for me personally, for example, I enjoy baking and cooking a lot. So a restaurant or a bakery is a very it's a good plan B.
For me, I'm really, as I said before, I'm really interested in teaching. So I hope to teach within physics, but I think if I wasn't a physicist, I'd probably have a job teaching something else.
What about you two?
I'll probably be like in a death metal band or something like that. But it pretty much sums it up, I guess.
What about you, Jake?
Probably an engineer, but that's not as awesome as the previous option.
Well, this has been such a great event. I just want to say thank you to our wonderful audience and to Greg for facilitating and taking questions from Twitter, and of course to the Perimeter Institute for having us all here tonight, and to Sun Life, our series sponsor. What a great discussion. I mean, it's been called one of the most exciting times ever to be a physicist with the pace of discovery. And I think, you know, from the what the four of you have said tonight, we can understand why. And it really speaks to kind of the promise of the years ahead. So I'm sure I speak for all of us when I say I can't wait to see what you all accomplish in your careers. And I know we'll all be watching so closely. So thank you for, you know, for sharing your perspectives tonight. Once again, our panel, we have Jacob Barnett, we have Andres Schlieff here, Lauren Hayward, and Nima Darood, and my name is Kate Luno. I'm a writer with Maclean's Magazine. Thank you so much for having us tonight.